Hello and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis of China's growing presence in the developing world. I co-host this podcast with Eric Mike Storino, who is also the founder, but is traveling right now in Japan, so can't join us. And I am Juliette Liu, your co-host and host for today. I am based in very sunny today, Vancouver, Canada. Also, a big shout out to our editor, Tylee Nee. She is a wonderful source of support and makes these episodes sound much better than I could. So welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about Latin America and the Caribbean, a number of different pieces and aspects of that. This region is one that oftentimes is referred to as the United States backyard. Where I work in Southeast Asia, we call it China's backyard, and not wanting to define these regions solely in relation to the nearest superpower, but it does make them a really fascinating places, both of them, to consider China's growing presence in the rest of the world. And I personally am always looking to deepen our coverage of Latin America and the Caribbean because it's out of my wheelhouse and it's so fascinating. China's engagements in the region have been steadily growing over the last decade or two. You might think of recent ways in which China is engaging in mining and infrastructure investment. And these investments have been welcome, but it's also a really interesting place for China because China has a kind of a widely overlooked but really rich diaspora in the area. There's a lot of central level support from Beijing to engage more in the region, but it's also a region that has a lot of influence from other players in the world, especially the U.S. The region is home to a number of the remaining countries that have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, most notably five different Caribbean states that we're going to talk about. And it's a region where China is seeking to deepen its engagement, but faces challenges and complications to that. So here to talk to us about China's presence in Latin America and the Caribbean is Leland Lazarus. He's the Associate Director of National Security at Florida International University's Jack D. Gordon Institute of Public Policy. He's a fascinating expert on China's relations with Latin America and the Caribbean. He manages researchers and interns that collect data and analysis on U.S. national security and governance in the region. He is fluent in Mandarin and Spanish, which is awesome. And he holds an MA in U.S.-China foreign policy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and did his BA in international relations at Brown. So he has bounced around and has tons of background on these topics. His past work experience includes work in the U.S. Embassy for Barbados and the Eastern Caribbean, the U.S. Consulate General in Shenyang, China. He speaks great Mandarin. And he formerly worked as an associate producer at China Central Television and a Fulbright scholar in Panama. So he is the perfect person to talk to about China and Latin America and the Caribbean. Leland, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Julia, thank you so much for the honor. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you. Okay, so you have a really fascinating background, multiple languages spoken and places worked in these regions. Can you tell us about yourself and how you ended up getting both such deep experience in China and in Latin America and the Caribbean?
Yeah, I would say that it all started in a dusty road in rural Panama. Okay. And let me explain. So I'm Panamanian American. Both my parents were born in Panama. But I was born and raised in New York, so I was very much a gringo. But when I was growing up, I always wanted to learn about the country of my heritage. I always tried to find ways to go back and meet family members, learn about the culture of my family. Around the time of college, I finally had that opportunity. And I spent several summers and then eventually a whole year after college to live in Panama. And I taught English out in the rural area. And I'll never forget, on a dusty road on the side of the school, there was a small shop run by a Chinese family. Right. And these small shops are actually ubiquitous all throughout Panama, so much so that they call them chinitos, right? Because all of them, right, or the vast majority of them, are run by Chinese families or Chinese immigrants. The family spoke absolutely fluent Spanish. They'd been in Panama for several years. And that sparked my curiosity of, wow, we're not even talking about in Panama City. We're talking about in a rural area out in the middle of nowhere. And yet there's Chinese presence here. So that caused me to do some more research about the Chinese diaspora in Panama, but then also throughout Latin America and the Caribbean in general, to find out that actually the diaspora has been in the region for centuries, since the 1800s, especially in the context of Panama. Chinese workers came to work on the Panama Canal and so on and so forth. And so I think that was the start of my fascination with the nexus between China and Latin America, and that eventually broadened to analyzing China's Belt and Road projects throughout the region.
That's great. And you worked in China as well. What was the deal with working at China Central Television? How did that happen?
Yeah. So my senior year of college, there was an opportunity to intern for CCTV. And this was 2012. This was a time when CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera were actually cutting back on man hours, right? But CCTV had just set up its North American division in DC. And I first started there as an intern in the DC office, and then also eventually worked for the headquarters in Beijing.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. This is such a great background. It's something that we're talking actually before we pressed record about how people outside of China need to know a lot about China. People in China should be learning a lot about places in the rest of the world. People like you are positioned to bridge that gap so interestingly. Let's get into some of your writing. So you start off one of your latest articles saying 2024 is a pivotal year for China and the global South. Why is that?
I'll say there's multiple reasons. The first is this year, China is going to have the 9th Forum on China and Africa Cooperation and is going to host the 5th China and Community for Latin America and the Caribbean, or CELAC Forum. It's really an opportunity for China to engage in both key regions in the global South, both Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean. But also, all eyes will be on Latin America and the Caribbean later on this year, because in mid-November, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit is going to happen in Peru. And then also the G20 is going to happen in Brazil.
Right.
And so Xi Jinping is expected to visit Peru, and I also think Brazil, during that time, in which he would announce the potential inauguration of a big mega port that's going to be inaugurated in the port of Chancay in Peru, and of course, strengthening further relationships with Brazil. I would say another reason why this year is so pivotal is we've been seeing how China has been shifting the priorities of the Belt and Road Initiative. We're seeing a Belt and Road 2.0, where we're no longer seeing these big, massive investments in these large projects, but instead a transition to what some of my colleagues, specifically a researcher, Margaret Myers, in the Inter-American Dialogue, she's done great research on this about new infrastructure. So a focus more on renewable energy projects, solar, electric vehicle plants, electricity grids, and mining of critical minerals like lithium. That's so important for the new age economy. So I think we're going to see a lot of that shift happening in China's engagement with the global South going forward.
Margaret has been on, I think, twice already, and she is super knowledgeable and great to work with. You mentioned FOCAC and then China CELAC. China CELAC was established in 2014. I think FOCAC was established very long time ago, decades ago, in 2006. I remember seeing it advertised, one of the first major meetings, but I think it was established in 2000. You describe China CELAC as being established on the model of FOCAC, but you also compare and contrast the two. What lessons do you think have been learned, and how do you compare the two forums?
Absolutely. And this was a privilege to write that piece with a colleague, Paul Nantulia, who's really a great scholar with regard to China-Africa relations. He's over at the National Defense University. We thought it would be interesting to compare and contrast the way China engages both FOCAC and CELAC. And the biggest and most obvious difference between the two was actually the nature in which both of them were created, right? So FOCAC was created with a specific goal of collaboration with China, right? CELAC was actually created a couple of years before the China-CELAC Forum. It was created in 2011, and it was rolled out in Venezuela. The idea behind that was a lot of Latin American and Caribbean countries, they felt like the U.S. had too much power and sway in the Organization of American States. And so they thought, hey, we need to create an independent forum or organization where we can really coordinate amongst ourselves, right? Without sort of big brother influencing those decisions. When you fast forward to from 2011 to 2013, when Xi Jinping officially announces the Belt and Road Initiative, and then 1 year after that in 2014, that's when they have the first official inauguration of the China CELAC Forum. What I mean to say is that CELAC was already created, already had a mechanism, a structure, and then the China CELAC Forum basically created systems that were grafted onto existing structures that already started when CELAC started in 2011. Now, FOCAC and CELAC, they share a lot of commonalities. A lot of them have similar sub-forums on media and defense and security and trade and investment and education. But I think that what we saw was that perhaps there could be more collaboration between leaders who participate in FOCAC and leaders of CELAC to share best practices and to even meet before they have their meetings with their Chinese counterparts in order to make sure they're really maximizing their relationship with China and that they are learning lessons and sharing best practices going forward.
It makes sense for Latin America and the Caribbean to have an interest in China as a counterweight to the U.S. somewhat. Did FOCAC also have that background? I know it's not your focus region, but do you think that's also baked into FOCAC?
Yeah, I think the China-Africa relationship had really been around ever since the 1950s, 50s, 60s. The Tanzania and Zambia Railway was the first major Chinese infrastructure project in Africa. And that was all the way back, announced in the 1960s and completed in 1976.
Oh, wow.
And I think the reasoning behind creating FOCAC was to actually create an official mechanism by which the continent and China can really collaborate. But it does go to a larger point, right? Which is that the global South, whether it be countries in Africa, whether it be countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, or even Southeast Asia, right, where your expertise is, many of them are trying to make sure they're not caught in a new Cold War mentality, right? Or they don't want to be forced to choose sides between the U.S. and China. They want to have agency and they want to chart their own path.
And I love how your article kind of frames, we'll link your article in the show notes as always, but the idea that the lessons can be learned across these regions and that the structure of these forums can actually facilitate not only those regions' relationship with China and China's engagement with those regions, but also that they can be parallel lessons learned across our regions is, I think, a great way to focus on understanding how they come about. So yeah, that was really interesting to read about. The Caribbean in particular is a fascinating place in terms of China's global engagements, partly because it's so close to the U.S. You refer to it as the U.S.'s third border. And then also across Latin America and the Caribbean, the relationship with Taiwan is super fascinating. So you had an article written for China Project in 2020 that talked about the competition between the U.S. and China. I'm just interested, years on now, how has that played out? Is China still a growing presence that the U.S. is specifically focused on and wary of in terms of its ties to Latin America and the Caribbean? Has there become a better balance since then?
I think it's gotten even more pronounced since 2020. And I'll give you a specific example. Every 3 years or so, China and CELAC, they announced a joint plan of action. And so this joint plan of action for 2022 to 2024, in it, China specifically states that they want to prioritize small island developing states in the Caribbean. So I found that quite interesting. They specifically singled out the Caribbean as a priority area. And we know that there are 10 Caribbean countries that are signatories of the BRI, and the investments have just become so multifaceted. And it's everything from a big north-south highway project in Jamaica, which really connects the north and the south of the country, that's already constructed by China Harbor Engineering Company. And I understand that Czech also has various other projects in the island, or the Phoenix Industrial Park in Trinidad and Tobago, or the VC Bird Airport in Antigua, Barbuda. You know, these are just three of many examples of the various infrastructure projects that now Chinese companies are engaging in throughout the Caribbean. With regard to the U.S., I feel like if you ask an average American and you ask them about the Caribbean, they think nice beaches, rum punch, a vacation area. And I think if you ask a U.S. policymaker in Washington about the Caribbean, they think Haiti, or they think potential drug trafficking or violence, right?
Yeah.
But the Caribbean is much more multifaceted than that. It's much more important. As you had mentioned before, it very much is a third border. I think that the U.S. ignores or deprioritizes the Caribbean at its own peril. I do want to just mention here that the Biden administration has done some really great work over the years in order to really recognize that. For example, Vice President Kamala Harris, on the sidelines of the Summit of the Americas, she announced the U.S.-Caribbean partnership against climate change, right? And so there is a growing recognition that we need to really put our money where our mouth is with regard to boosting engagement with the Caribbean. But still, I think that China's engagement is still alive and well and will continue to increase in the region for years to come.
Yeah, it's really these smaller countries where they're so small for China, but they're so huge for the countries where they take place. It's really fascinating. And U.S. and Western development aid has waned since the 2000s overall, but really in this region, it's such a fascinating dynamic between China and that longer history of engagement from the U.S.
Yeah, I would just say a little goes a long way. When I was a diplomat in Barbados in the Eastern Caribbean, the criticism we constantly got was, where have you been, U.S., right? What have you done for us lately? I also remember distinctly one of the projects we had to do throughout the embassy, which our deputy chief of mission required us to do, was to come up with fact sheets, the kind of one-pager fact sheet summarizing all of the different projects and investment that the U.S. has in each of the countries, so that when a prime minister comes to our ambassador and says, you haven't done anything for us lately, she could easily bring up that one page and say, right. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Look at all this stuff. And so I think part of the issue was strategic communication. Like we do a lot, right? But is it packaged in a way that's digestible for the everyday peoples of the Caribbean to know that, hey, a certain project here or a certain hospital here in my neighborhood was actually created with money from the U.S. Agency of International Development, from the Development Finance Corporation and stuff like that. I wasn't too sure that we were doing the best job at actually telling our story and getting the due credit of the projects that we were actually supporting throughout the region.
I totally buy that. People were making the same point about U.S. development aid in Africa on the Seneca podcast recorded. I think it was like recorded in December, but they were talking mostly about Africa, some phrase that African leaders had said, like, when the U.S. comes, we get a lecture. When China comes, we get a road.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of debate about this, like the U.S. and other Western aid organizations have shifted away from hard infrastructure. And it's so much harder to see programs that you can't see and touch. And China has gone for that. They've really embraced that you can see and touch these infrastructure projects. I think it's a double-edged sword because infrastructure projects are also so damaging sometimes. But we totally, and I just finally got back to Laos after many years in December and spoke to folks in the U.S. Embassy there. We see the same thing. They're actually doing a good amount of work, but they usually wrap that into UN agencies. And then the branding of the intervention is not US forward. It's oftentimes buried in theirs. I think there's multiple sides to the issue. But the idea that from the regional leader's point of view, that mm-hmm. there is constantly this question of when they're taking stuff from China, it's an interesting contrast to US automatically. What you said you've seen on the ground, I think totally tracks for other regions as well.
Again, I also think that the US government has gotten smarter. This messaging of not necessarily forcing countries to choose, right? Mm-hmm. But warnings about not taking money or loans from China rings hollow, especially in the small island developing states like the Caribbean. And mm-hmm. why is that? Because what I understand is that a lot of the Caribbean countries are considered middle income to high middle income countries based off of the way that the IMF and the World Bank designates these countries. That really pisses a lot of the Caribbean leaders off because one, based on old, antiquated kind of per capita income, right? And so if you're heavily dependent on tourism and you're getting a lot of revenue from really wealthy Americans or really wealthy British folks, they're artificially bringing up the per capita income, right? But the vast majority of the population is actually not middle income and high middle income, right? So yeah. That's one. Two is indicators of middle income and high middle income didn't take into account climate vulnerability, right? So if I'm the island of Dominica, sure, I might have economic growth for several years, but then it really takes just one hurricane. This happened to Dominica, right? 2018, right. Hurricane Maria came and wiped out the vast majority of the island. Leaders like the Prime Minister, Mia Mottley of Barbados, really been a champion in the international space to really advocate to say, listen, the designations that these international financial institutions make, they need to be updated. They need to take into account the climate vulnerabilities that Caribbean countries deal with on a daily basis. And they need to have more access to concessional loans, right? Because otherwise, they're not able to get those loans. And then they have no choice but to go to China Development Bank, China Exim Bank, and so forth.
Right, yeah. Getting advice that they should be getting warnings about taking Chinese loans. What are the alternatives? And they're saying exactly. There's not a ton of alternatives. Yeah,
exactly.
The zero-sum framing of China's activity in the Caribbean being a direct competition with the U.S., it seems like you would complicate that with all the things that you already mentioned. I was also going to ask, are there areas U.S. and China can cooperate or just coexist? It seems there's room for both of them, especially if there's been a lack of loans, a lack of an aid, and this demand for also the climate side adaptation. And yeah, do you have any other thoughts to include about the zero-sum versus room for both U.S. and China to cooperate?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I actually want to highlight the work by a close colleague. Her name is Torella Moses at Boston University. She's a data manager and researcher on Chinese loans and trade with Africa. And a few years ago, she wrote a really interesting article about potential complementarity between BRI and the G7's Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, PGII. Mm. Just like what you said, Julia, PGI is more focused on soft infrastructure, right? Digital connectivity, health, education, you name it, while BRI has traditionally been hard infrastructure, right? So you can absolutely imagine in maybe more rosy times in the future where the US and China can potentially cooperate, where BRI and PGI projects can be complementary, right? But you have a health project around a key hospital that was done with BRI funding or something like that. I'm sure that's definitely not going to happen anytime soon, given the political climate. But it might be interesting too, given the fact that, going back to what we had mentioned before, the shift in this BRI 2.0 focused on smaller but more beautiful, that's what, you know, Xi Jinping has called them, smaller but more beautiful projects, focused on more soft infrastructure kind of thing. Now we're getting into more direct competition between BRI 2.0 and what the US and our allies and partners are offering as well.
Yeah. And so two questions ago, I asked also about Taiwan. You wrote that of the 12 countries that still maintain diplomatic relations with Taiwan, seven of them are in this region. You've got Belize, Guatemala, Haiti, Paraguay, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and St. Kitts and Nevis. What's the deal with that relationship? Is it just left over from older times? And to what extent does it directly butt up against the region's growing connections with China? Or is it just not talked about?
No, it's very much talked about. And unfortunately, the trend is against Taiwan's favor.
Yeah.
And why do I say that? Because the past just few years, already Taiwan has lost two more diplomatic allies in the region, Nicaragua and Honduras. And then since 2017, it lost Panama, Dominican Republic, Costa Rica in 2006. So it's a concerning trend for sure. I think that the seven countries that are still diplomatic allies to Taiwan remain so because these are relatively small economies in which what Taiwan has to offer is enough. But there's always a temptation, there's always that pressure on the part of externally, right, on the part of the PRC, but also internally from potential exporters, chambers of commerce, and business leaders within the countries saying, hey, we should have more access to the second largest economy in the world so that we can export our stuff. Paraguay is a perfect example of this. I understand that a lot of beef exporters have been clamoring for quite some time to say, hey, we want to export more of our beef to the Chinese market. And really the biggest impediment to that is our diplomatic relations with Taiwan. But again, for now, the relationship with its seven diplomatic allies are quite strong. Taiwan has been a faithful diplomatic ally. It focuses on medical projects like a multi-million dollar hospital that it stood up in Guatemala. They just agreed to give $16 million for creating a hospital in Belize. They support small business owners in Paraguay. They've supported a digital connectivity project in St. Lucia, agricultural technical missions, and Mandarin language scholarships. So the good that Taiwan does is very palpable. And so I think that the diplomatic allies that are still here in this region for Taiwan do recognize the tangible benefits of having a democratic partner.
It's interesting because though you make it sound like it's not just China pushing, oh, if you want to join the Belt and Road Initiative, you have to disavow your ties with Taiwan, but that there are these business cases within the country that they're also shifting in that direction. The idea that there is some match, that Taiwan can contribute a lot in these places is also fascinating.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this because I actually just came back from a trip to Taiwan a couple of weeks ago. It was through a program funded by the German Marshall Fund. There were 10 of us, we were 10 China researchers, five from the US, five from Europe. I had the opportunity to talk to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, specifically their Western Hemisphere, sort of Latin America and Caribbean division, to learn more about what are their priorities in the region. Also met with their Ministry of sort of Commerce, Ministry of Trade. And you find out that actually, I think Taiwan has a good window of opportunities right now because it's seen as such a global leader in the semiconductor industry, right? TSMC creating 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductors, but also a leader in artificial intelligence, in cybersecurity. And these are exactly the kinds of new age industries and technologies that Latin American and Caribbean countries want to develop. So who's a better partner than Taiwan to help them do that? So I think Taiwan can really play up those benefits and provide, whether it be technology transfer or skills training, to upskill local workforces in this kind of new age technology, not only for its diplomatic allies, but also for countries that maybe have already switched from Taiwan to China, but still maintain trade with Taiwan or still have a Taiwan economic and cultural office. And there are 9 offices in Latin America and the Caribbean that are still there in non-diplomatic allies of Taiwan.
It's somewhere I don't think of as having such a Taiwan presence, but it totally makes sense just in terms of how that's been preserved. So a complete switch, pretty much. But I want to get into your work studying Chinese actors' involvement in organized crime in the region. And I'm just going to flag for our listeners that, you know, Leland does a ton of fascinating research on a bunch of different topics. And then within the organized crime topic, there's more to this in a report that I'll link and beyond. But we're just going to stick to a few BRI-related questions to pique your interest and get you guys to read more. Can you sketch out what are the main activities that Chinese criminal groups in Latin America and the Caribbean mainly engage in?
Yeah. Let me first preface this by saying we found no evidence of direct involvement or direct connections between these criminal groups and the PRC or the Communist Party. We didn't even really see a large sort of industrial scale of transnational organized crime, but it still exists, right? These are illegal groups and illegal individuals of Chinese origin who operate in various countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. They engage in one or multiple of these 4 illicit activities, which is the selling of fentanyl. We know, of course, that fentanyl has become a huge issue in the United States, you know, killed 100,000 Americans last year, and is really the leading cause of death for Americans ages 18 to 49. So it's a huge issue. The supply chain is usually that the fentanyl precursors are being created and sent from factories in China to Mexico, and sort of the Sinaloa cartel and other cartel groups then package them and transform them into potent fentanyl pills, and then it ends up on U.S. streets. So that's 1. 2 is money laundering. There's an increasing number of, again, individuals with links, quasi-links to triads and other illegal Chinese groups who are laundering money for various transnational criminal organizations in Latin America and the Caribbean. And they usually do it through what they call like the flying money system, usually through cryptocurrencies and things like that. The 3rd is wildlife trafficking. Think about the selling of shark fins and jaguar fangs and skins being shipped to China to be then used for traditional Chinese medicine. And last but not least is human smuggling. We've seen a massive increase in illegal Chinese migrants that are coming up to the U.S. Southwest border. And they're usually flying from China to Turkey, from Turkey to Ecuador, because Ecuador has a visa-free agreement with China. And then they either walk up literally from Ecuador all the way through between Colombia and Panama, all the way through Central America, through Mexico and ending up there. Or if they have a little bit more money, they can pay for a bus or even a plane to take them much further so that they can get to the U.S. much faster. That's an increasing trend as well.
You make the case that they're all interconnected in some ways. But you mentioned to start out with that, yeah, you say really clearly there's no evidence that this is PRC involved. And I've seen that too in Southeast Asia. You get a lot of the PRC is very concerned about the influx of drugs into their own country. And so you brought that up as a parallel to their being less engaged in the fentanyl issue in the U.S. and in Latin America and Caribbean. But at the same time, you quote a U.S. Treasury Department report that says a lot of these organizations, they have legal fronts to them, right? And that they flaunt their connections with Chinese government agencies. And many of them have legal operations that announce that they are Belt and Road Initiative operations. And I should just say, across other episodes that we've done, this is really common. The idea that once the BRI was launched and became such a powerful branding and campaign, that a bunch of people have said that they are doing Belt and Road Initiative projects for a while became shorthand for anything that China was doing abroad. I don't know, anyone who has like a Chinese uncle and or dad like I do knows that Chinese people will flaunt their Guanxi. Oh, yeah. Right, and so right. This is, you got to like plenty of Chinese government connections. But the U.S. Treasury Department is picking this up and saying they're flaunting their connections with Chinese government agencies. Is that just a legitimizing technique solely from the actors in the region who are trying to legitimize themselves? Who is the audience for that? And what do you think of that little mention that I picked out that I thought was really interesting?
Yeah, this is a kind of a cop-out answer, but it really depends, right? I think of, in the context of Southeast Asia, this guy who was affiliated or part of the leadership of the 14K triads, Broken Tooth, Juan Kukoi, who was also head of this like Hongmen, right? Global Hongmen Brotherhood. This Hongmen group directly supports RI projects around the world or Southeast Asia in particular. But he was also engaged in illicit activities, like gambling, drug trafficking, and smuggling, and things like that. Something similar is happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. ProPublica, for example, did a report about this one guy who was Chinese, but grew up in Mexico, spoke fluent Spanish, fluent Mandarin, and fluent Cantonese, right, in Fujianhua. He helped to facilitate drug smuggling and money laundering and whatnot across the Mexico-US border. He apparently also flaunted connections or ties to Chinese government officials. Now, does that mean that the Chinese government is directly involved in that, right? Or is this sort of a one-off, just this one guy, or maybe just a group of people? It's really hard to say. But I do want to highlight the work of one of our NGO partners called Earth League International. And if the readers or listeners, if you haven't heard of ELI, Earth League International, you guys got to look them up, specifically Andrea Crosta. He's the head of it. They basically embed themselves in these various illicit groups all throughout the region. And he's hired sort of folks who are either Taiwanese American or Hong Kongese American, folks who can speak the local dialect, can embed themselves for months in these groups. And they have uncovered incredible connections. One of them being a group that's based in Bolivia. That group is involved in all kinds of different illicit activities, drug smuggling, but also human trafficking and illegal mining. And allegedly, they have helped a Chinese state-owned enterprise that's also operating in Bolivia win certain contracts. This is another example of this kind of gray area between the state and private sector and the state and illicit activities. It's hard to really tell to what extent the hand of the Chinese Communist Party in any of this.
My imagination is going wild, as I think it does with anyone who's reading about organized crime. But I'm like, man, this guy speaks Fujianhua, he speaks Cantonese, he speaks Putonghua, he speaks Spanish. You could take that same set of skills and either become an international spy, a diplomat, or a gangster.
Exactly.
There's a great description in your report of how rich the Chinese diaspora is. You mentioned, was it Chinitos? The small mom and pop stores, the Chinese mom and pop stores in Panama. These people are positioned both as great, really small business owners and excellent facilitators of foreign investment from China and potentially of foreign Chinese organized crime. It's just there's so much overlap with the same skill set.
Yeah. And Julia, you're a Mandarin speaker. So this whole idea of like, Zheng Yijian, Bi Yijian, right? Yeah. And so to what extent is that going on too? Turning a blind eye to illicit activities that may be going on. If I can give just one more example, which is the human smuggling or the journey of illegal Chinese migrants who are coming to the U.S.-Mexico Southwest border. We understand that along the way, because they can find on Douyin or Weibo or any of these sort of step-by-step guides on, hey, when you get to this country, you need to talk to this guy or you need to go to this Chinese restaurant where you know they can help you out and help you find another guide and stuff like that, right? So the Chinese restaurants or Chinese laundromats or these Chinese karaoke bars or casinos, they also become areas where you can continue to facilitate human smuggling. Not all of these legitimate businesses are involved in this, but some.
You have snapshots of the instructions online, which are super fascinating. I want to touch quickly on the fentanyl crisis. This has been one of the ways that China and Latin America and the Caribbean has been in the news in the U.S. recently. Many Chinese suppliers are providing precursor chemicals to processing operations in the region, in Latin America and the Caribbean, that then ship fentanyl into the U.S. There's a lot of blame to go around when it comes to what Chinese authorities are doing to stop that from happening, Latin American and the Caribbean regional authorities, what their role is, and then U.S. efforts. And then you've got just how complicated the drug crisis is. How do you parse out the responsibility to roles that these different regional authorities play? Are they cooperating? And if so, is it successful? Has it been changing recently? What's the state of affairs in that area?
The hard part is the Chinese side consistently denies that it's a Chinese problem. They consistently say, wait a minute, the issue of fentanyl, that's not a China issue. This is a Mexico issue. This is a U.S. issue. You guys get your act together. We don't need to really do anything. I do want to be a little bit optimistic, because when President Xi and President Biden met in San Francisco last year for APEC, they did discuss collaboration on stopping the flow of fentanyl. What I understand is that there has since been a delegation of various U.S. law enforcement officers to China in order to follow up on that, and that there has been a slight decrease in the fentanyl precursors that have been sent over to Mexico. That being said, given the tense competitive relationship between the U.S. and China, there really isn't incentive on the Chinese side to help out.
Yeah.
Other than potential goodwill. We've seen before, this is the same thing, by the way, when we're talking about military ties or negotiations and collaboration, we'll set up some sort of forum or mechanism for dialogue with China. But as soon as there's a flashpoint or issue in the relationship, they'll shut that down. So who knows if another flare up like the spy balloon incident last February, if something like that flares up again, or God forbid a issue happens over Taiwan, will the collaboration that has restarted between U.S. and Chinese officials and Mexican officials on fentanyl just be dropped for the sake of political posturing?
I imagine that China getting its hands dirty might be an admission of guilt or admission of responsibility. In some ways, even though I tend to see the global opioid crisis as everything is interconnected and placing blame is irrelevant. It's just such an intractable issue. But I can imagine it being sticky, and that, yeah, you also make the point China has no skin in the game. It doesn't benefit from that other than as a diplomatic negotiating piece. But I imagine, like you said, that visit would make a difference of U.S. drug enforcement agents to China, and any kind of cross communication, I assume, helps.
Yeah.
Just to wrap up this stuff on organized crime, you characterize Chinese organized crime activities as converging, like they're all interrelated, is how I understand the meaning of that. Do you think that, going back to the Belt and Road Initiative, do you think China's growing global engagements writ large through the Belt and Road Initiative and beyond, do those also mean that China's organized crime networks hitch a ride on those projects as well? Or is that just too hard to tell, or maybe case by case specific?
That's a great question. It's definitely too hard to tell. I wouldn't dare make any pronouncements without actually seeing the data to back that up. Actually, that's actually a really good follow-on research project. I think there are interesting data points here. So one is, everybody knows about aid data from William & Mary and just the incredible data set that they have of the 20,000 or so BRI projects around the world. They assessed that of all those projects, about 35% of them were flagged for having some issue in terms of corruption or labor violation or undue delays or whatnot. Taking that from a grander scale to a smaller scale focused on Latin America and the Caribbean, we have seen that as well. We can corroborate that. We, over the past year, have been doing a project where we're aggregating all Chinese activities throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. This is our Chinese activities in LAC dashboard. So think of it like you can see the whole map of the region. You have hundreds and hundreds of dots. Each dot is a certain project. You can click on that project and it'll come up with, this is the name of the project, the year it was built. This is the Chinese company behind it. And oh, by the way, this is the Chinese company's subsidiaries and parents. And these are its connections, potential connections to PRC or specifically the PLA. And this is also its history of environmental damage, corruption, labor violation, everything like that. This is our way of hopefully, not dirty work, but doing the hard work of investigative journalists and others who might want to do some more digging into various Chinese projects in their own countries and whether they are actually providing economic and societal benefit to their countries.
Getting a project-specific view across the region is really great.
And not just project-specific, but also SOE, right? State-owned enterprise-specific. Because, Juliet, I've always been an advocate of nuance with regard to China's engagement with the Global South, and not demonizing all Chinese companies, because there are some Chinese companies that are doing quite good things in the region, right? And have built great projects that have added to local economic growth. I can lift up BYD, for example, right? It's great that they're building electric vehicle plants in Uruguay and Brazil and elsewhere. But some state-owned enterprises that have consistently engaged in problematic behavior, behavior with corruption, consistent behavior with environmental damage, and so on and so forth, which would hopefully allow local government officials and local journalists to say, listen, we should probably be a little bit more cautious about this company in particular when this company is bidding on a certain contract or trying to get involved in a certain project in my country.
Yeah, I think countries across the world that are host countries, they need some background information on different types of investors and what their track record is elsewhere, which was hard to get 10 years ago, but now is increasingly available through tools like this. I can see that being really useful. I just want to ask a concluding question. And again, to our listeners, there's tons more that Leland has written on these topics and beyond. So just overall kind of gut level predictions, or if you have specifics that you can reach for, what are your predictions for China's engagement in Latin America and the Caribbean going forward?
I think the exact same. I'm looking at how is 20% youth unemployment, the housing bubble that's already popped, the massive debt among provincial and municipal governments, the tanking stock market and other domestic economic issues. How is that going to impact China's engagement, economic engagement globally? Because that ostensibly means that either Chinese policymakers or Chinese development banks won't necessarily have the bandwidth to focus and to go out like they did over the past 20 years. But I expect to see, again, more new infrastructure projects, smaller but beautiful, more focus on electric vehicles. That's definitely an area to look out for. Not just BYD, but also Chery, Gotion, other Chinese brands that are building manufacturing plants all throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. That's going to be interesting. Law enforcement, that's something that we haven't really talked about yet, but for various Latin American and Caribbean countries, economic growth is one priority, but security is another key priority. There are so many different cities that are suffering from violence and gang violence and transnational criminal organizations, and countries are looking for any partner to help them with that. And so you're seeing an increase in Chinese law enforcement diplomacy, whether it be inviting law enforcement officers from the region to take classes at various police academies in China, to the export of safe city, smart city surveillance technology from Huawei and ZTE and Dahua and Hikvision for facial recognition technology and surveillance cameras and the like. So that's an area to look out for. China's also either already finalized or is finalizing various free trade agreements. They just inked one with Ecuador. And so you'll definitely expect an increase in China-Ecuador trade over the next several years. But also they're in negotiations with Honduras for an FTA with Uruguay, although that has been stalled time and time again because Uruguay is a part of Mercosur and the other Mercosur countries have put a kibosh on those negotiations. And last but not least is the Taiwan question. We always need to be thinking about who or which country could be the next country to decide to switch diplomatic recognition. And I hope I'm wrong, but I'm not looking favorably at Guatemala. The president there, Bernardo Arevalo, has said on the campaign trail that, hey, we can boost our economic relations with the PRC and still maintain our diplomatic relations with Taiwan. He's going to find out real fast that you can't have your cake and eat it too. So I think there's definitely another country to look out for with the China-Taiwan tug of war in Latin America and the Caribbean.
I'll be watching for all of this. It's been wonderful to chat with you. Thank you so much for joining. Can you stick around for a minute for recommendations?
Absolutely.
Awesome. You are listening to the Belt and Road podcast, which covers the latest news, analysis, and conversations on China's growing presence in the developing world. We have Twitter and also we're on Facebook. So follow us at Belt and Road Pod. And so Leland, what do you have to recommend for us that interests you beyond what we've chatted about today?
First, I definitely want to foot stomp our Chinese activities in Latin America dashboard. And we're actually about to roll out a 2.0 of it as well, where we're incorporating AI to ingest more information so that when a new project is announced, it will automatically populate onto the map, and adding AI feature to actually figure out some potential trends, right? Historically, China's investment has been in X, Y, and Z. Well, based on that, where our Chinese company is going to be going in the future and which priority countries does China have in the region and things like that. That's one. Two is next month, May 9th and 10th, we're going to be having our FIU flagship conference called the Hemispheric Security Conference.
Okay.
It is basically a conference that talks about all the security and economic issues affecting Latin America and the Caribbean. But this year, we're very much focused on China's engagement in the region, also Taiwan's engagement in the region, and other allies and partners. Think Japan and South Korea and the EU and others. So it's going to have a real big international component. If folks are interested in something like that, you should totally come down to nice, warm Miami. And the conference is free.
Wow, amazing. Shouldn't have to sell it too hard to come down to Miami. That'd be great. I'm going to just recommend something that came up. It's not coming out until June, but a colleague of mine, Eli Friedman, who I knew at Cornell, he and a couple other authors, Kevin Lin, Rosa Liu, and Ashley Smith, have China and Global Capitalism, Building International Solidarity Against Imperial Rivalry. It should be really interesting. I haven't read it yet. I've just read some of the reviews, which are great. But I think there's an increasing amount of writing and analysis on just what China's emergence means for global capitalism that I find really fascinating. That's what I was going to recommend, but mostly I'm recommending that people take a look at Leland's other readings. They're super interesting. The piece on organized crime has great Chinese phrases in it, and the title is Triads, Snakeheads, and Flying Money. So it's very catchy and very interesting. Leland, thank you so much for talking with me, and I just really appreciate you coming on the show.
Juliet, thank you so much for the honor. It was a pleasure.